After all this, you still...
I still want that gas, yes. And you had better deliver.
Welcome back to the Greenhouse, dear listeners. I'm joined by an old guest. You'll probably remember him from the first two episodes. Which means you're now in the Challenge Coin Club, Zach. Welcome back.
Oh, thank you. The Challenge Coin Club, huh?
Yeah, I'm thinking about instead of actually getting you guys Challenge Coins minted, I'll release them as NFTs.
All right.
Let's do that. Being said, people are just going to download the JPEG. So. I wanted to have you on mainly just to talk about the Civil War, mainly because it's a subject both me and you have talked about before, but also like not to reveal too much. I'm in a group chat with some of our guests, and this harkens back to like a conversation we were having earlier in the year, and I was bringing up John Brown for whatever reason. And when like 7/8 of that group chat didn't know who John Brown was, I'm like, uh-oh. Oh, we're doing bad, folks.
Yeah, yeah. But at least the redeeming thing that happened was that you and I, basically in all caps, were chatting the lyrics to John Brown's Body, which which did redeem some of that discussion for me personally.
And I think, like, you know, there's something to be said about the Civil War as a topic that keeps coming up, right? And it's this time that's dynamically understood as like pivotal, but most people's understanding of it actually tends to be like pretty boilerplate, pretty much like, you know, spit and chew what they remember out of high school and trying to like, you know, reduce it down to like very simple narratives, when it was probably like the most like live wire period in US history. There was a lot going on dynamically, not just from like a conflict standpoint, but even like some of the politics and the social conditions on the ground.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you can't exactly draw a straight line from any point to today, but at the same time, like, the Civil War was like a result of, you know, conditions that came up in the founding, and some of the new order created after the Civil War is, you know, what determines our reality today. And I guess we should maybe get to, you know, where this understanding starts, you know, which is in education. Do you want to maybe comment on like what learning about the Civil War was like for you in high school and middle school?
Yeah, sure. I mean, with anything, with such a massive topic as the American Civil War, I think there's always more information that, you know, we can opine should be discussed. And I think that there's a lot of merit to those contentions. But I will say, at least in my high school, I grew up around Macomb Township, went to Macomb, Dakota High School. I think they did a fairly decent job. I was in AP U.S. History. Fairly decent job at summarizing the major events in U.S. history. And I think the American Civil War, the abolition of slavery, and all that. I think they definitely hit those points, but those topics probably deserve, if there is time, a larger underscoring. And I think, and I don't say that as a criticism of my high school or the AP U.S. history teacher. She was great, and we definitely did touch on those points. We touched on abolitionist figures like John Brown, Harriet Tubman, Frederick Douglass, and all of them as well. And we definitely touched on parts of the Civil War. But with anything, when you only have a year to discuss all of the major events over hundreds of years, you're only going to hit a couple of days of that part of the curriculum. So while definitely they hit those points, you don't get the greater expansion onto some of the contemporary issues today surrounding the Civil War. I mean, we can all think about the statues controversy, and you have people on one side, the wrong side, saying that these Confederate statues represent solely a matter of history, and then I feel like you have some people on the other side trying to, and very few, but trying to take down statues of Lincoln, and I think that some of these topics like you said, they don't form a direct line from the Civil War to today, but there's definitely a squiggly line, a zigzag that you can connect to the history, the narratives from the Civil War on and afterward. So I guess in summation, I'm saying that although we did touch on the major talking points in my high school classroom, you don't get the connection to today necessarily explained to you. Those inferences come later. And I'm not sure what it was like for you or if you've had a similar experience, but that was what it was like for me.
Yeah, no, because like I also took AP US History, and I guess we both took it around the time before they revised the syllabus pretty cruelly. So it was pretty rigorous in that sense. And I think you got into a lot of good stuff there, which is really painting the contours of this meta discussion we're going to have about like those, I guess, less savory aspects of American history that, you know, did get addressed in the prior syllabus that I think, do you remember the controversy around it where it's like some Southern states didn't want it taught as explicitly?
Do you mean specifically the parts about slavery and
specifically those, yes,
on secession being slavery?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Definitely. That seems to have been I can't remember when that was in the news, but definitely the I don't know what you would say it, but the watering down of just how much of a mundane horror slavery was and exactly how much of a focus that was for the South seceding. Definitely it's uncomfortable, but a lot of curricula need to discuss it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think like, you know, that it kind of got rehashed again in that statues discussion, right? There's this, you know, popular point that gets tossed around by that camp of, well, isn't this part of history? But how we discuss it, how we paint the contours of it is what we're really speaking about. And when we talk about, you know, the removal of Confederate monuments, right? So, you know, the often ill-discussed or like poorly discussed part of that is that a lot of these Confederate statues came up, you know, not immediately during Reconstruction. A lot of these tended to come up during segregation.
Yeah.
As a way to like, you know, kind of bully people effectively.
To intimidate, to say this is where we're at. You have a Confederate general, essentially, you know, most of whom owning slaves themselves, standing tall over these communities. And what does that say to the black and brown people in those communities? It's intimidation, and you're exactly right. They didn't come up immediately during or after the large majority of these statues. They came up as part of the like revival or revitalization of the Confederacy name, better known as the Lost Cause myth. Mm-hmm. This kind of it's not marketing, but this rebranding.
It is rebranding. It is because this comes out of, go ahead.
Yeah. It comes out of, it's this rebranding that, oh, we can't today think of anyone fighting that hard to preserve the institution of slavery, but that's exactly what was going on. At least at the large political level. And for many of the Confederate soldiers, I mean, so many, all things associated, we can get into more later. But instead of it being cast as that, the Confederacy being cast as that, it's being cast as this glorious, tragic, almost win that we fought to the bitter end. And I mean, it's compelling when you say it like that, but that's unfortunately just not how it happened. That's omitting a large part of the truth, which is that there was a legitimate, substantial effort by the losing side to preserve the institution of slavery and to prevent the things associated with emancipation, like amalgamation of the races, like what was what was called servile insurrection, the fear that formerly enslaved people would rise up and take out the white people. Of course, that didn't happen. So it was a baseless fear. I mean, it was all of those things in one, but primarily to preserve the oppression of a whole race.
Right. And it's one of those things that all these narratives you brought out, it's good that you did, because these weren't even like immediately brought up in the wake of Reconstruction. I mean, broadly speaking, how Andrew Johnson handled Reconstruction, you know, it pretty much let him up easy. And a lot of this, you know, rebranding came out of the Dunning School. I forget the professor's name. I know his last name's Dunning, and I forgot where he taught at. But, you know, noted disciples include Woodrow Wilson. And a lot of those myths or those, like, rebrands came out of this school, and particularly the Lost Cause myth, particularly this kind of depiction of Northern generals like Grant as like alcoholics and, you know, incompetent for their role, they only won because they got lucky type of stuff. And even like, you know, certain discussions about John Brown as excessively bloodthirsty come out of the Dunning School. Or I mean there's a whole tradition of Civil War conspiracy theory, and I guess, like, you know, you can trace some of those origins back to the Dunning School, but it's very unique in terms of like how much later the Dunning School comes after Reconstruction. Like, I want to say more so during the Gilded Age, I think, is when they came about. And I should probably, you know, underscore and disclose that, like, neither of us are fucking experts.
we're just two dudes talking.
like if you cite us in a paper, or if you like are, you know, trying to learn something for homework, don't fucking cite us.
We'll reach out to your professor and tell them to
we will snitch on you to your
points
professor.
Off. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, and although I'm not familiar with the particular name or time frame of the Dunning School, I am familiar with the effort of the Lost Cause myth and championed by those like President Woodrow Wilson. I can't remember what the movie he cast at the White House was, but it was some blatant
Birth of a Nation,
Ku Klux Klan, Birth of a Nation, exactly, Ku Klux Klan propaganda that kind of helped jumpstart this. I can't say it wasn't already jumpstarted, but it definitely underscored and emphasized and amplified this era of racism that comes in the early 1900s. And you do see that. You see, on one side, you see the glorification of this tragic lost cause of that is the Confederacy, and at the same time, you see the smearing of generally, you know, putatively good figures in history, like Grant, general and then president. I mean, that's the guy, to quote the YouTube channel Latoon Shay, that's the guy who saved the Union. I mean, you do have a legitimate criticism against Northern generals for at first sluggishly fighting the war and being slow to victories. But when, you know, generals George Meade and Sherman and especially
they don't name
Grant.
Them like that anymore. George Weed.
Yeah, George Weed. George Weed. Yeah, he's. Yeah, but especially General Grant too, coming in and displaying tactical brilliance and turning the tide of the war with Vicksburg, finally something going well for the Union, and then Meade with Gettysburg. And as a crucial part of that, and then Grant basically leading the last campaign to stop General Lee, and people don't really talk about this too, but President Grant, for all the criticism he gets for some of the corruption in his administration, that kind of being just the way things happened at that time, and Grant probably not having any personal knowledge of it himself, you can criticize him for that. I mean, the buck stops there. But I mean, people don't really talk about how under President Grant, the Ku Klux Klan was basically reduced to rubble. And it only came back later because of some of the failings of future administrations or lackluster response or resurgent racism. I mean, you had this like progressive era immediately after the Civil War where rights were bestowed upon more citizens, especially the formerly enslaved people. You had the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendment and Civil Rights Acts in the 1870s. And that all kind of moved away following Grant and his presidency, and especially in the decades to follow. And then you get people like President Wilson, and you get the early 1900s through the mid 1900s just being awful in terms of civil rights and racism, especially the racism. So
good solid stuff there. I mean, no, we wrapped that up so well. Fuck.
No, you're good. You're good. I had another 3 hours of that. I'm just kidding.
I'm trying to think. What are, because like you've mentioned here, there's a lot of deeper interplay going on in some of these events that gets left out, and there's this kind of like bland view of the Civil War. And granted, like, most people's view of history can be like that. It's just point A to point B, this guy, here's the answer you got to blot out on the test. But there was a lot of like crazy shit that went on in the Civil War. Like,
yeah.
Do you have like a favorite like Civil War moment, or like just a crazy Civil War story that sticks out to you?
Oh, geez. I don't know. I mean, the whole thing was so dynamic. I have to kind of summarize, you know, my mile wide view of the Civil War. I mean, you had the South getting off to early victories and stalemates that were unexpected by the armed superior North. And then it wasn't only, you know, it wasn't till closer to the latter parts of the Civil War that the North really started to kind of move over the South and secure the victory. I think there are some in Civil War circles, and I'm not really in these circles, but I've heard of these. There's a lot of like for or love for some of the brave moments in the Battle of Gettysburg. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking like the counter charge. I think the name is General, or it wasn't General, it was a Colonel Neville Chamberlain. I think he's a Colonel. Coming out of the left flank of Gettysburg and basically being out of ammo, and I believe outnumbered too. But instead of retreating from the crucial point in the left flank of the Union Army, just retreating down a hill and scaring off and routing the Confederate troops. I mean, that's a battle moment, but that just shows like crazy courage. And that could have gone a lot differently if that didn't happen. So it's kind of a heroic moment in that regard. But in terms of like, I guess that's kind of like more military strategy. If you're talking like political maneuvering and you're talking about political maneuvering and good things that happen politically. I mean, I think that the signing of the Emancipation Proclamation is one of the climaxes of the Civil War. I mean, not only did it purport to free, you know, so many people, but it also kind of started to secure the victory for the North. I mean, you had players in Europe like Britain flirting with supporting the Confederacy if they were to win several more battles. But over there, the idea of supporting supporting the side that is pro-slavery against the side that is anti-slavery was not something that they wanted to do. So the Emancipation Proclamation, not only doing the morally right thing, but also politically smart and securing the, avoiding the support for the South.
Right.
I think that that's a huge one, moral victory, but two, political maneuver that is fascinating when you think about it in that light.
Oh yeah.
It's kind of like an opportunistic moment.
It was, but I think, like, you know, there's a lot to be said about, like, was it just political maneuvering, or is it also the fact that, like, the war enabled them to finally make that call? To me, it's also, like, indicative of, like, Lincoln's persona, you know what I mean? People talk about him like he was uncommittal, or he evolved his positions over time. My read of him, and, you know, talking about political figures in abstract is rough because you never know what they were thinking. My read is just he had to say whatever he had to say for a certain audience, and however much he'd budge was dependent on really what he thought. And passing the 13th Amendment to me is like, you know, that was where he had finally gone from it's something that could be done to something that should be done to something that must be done.
Yeah.
And I think that's, you know, what people talk about when they talk about his, you know, moral position.
You know, Lincoln is a very fascinating political figure that I will say, you know, with those people that you're saying, you know, they discuss Lincoln and his evolving. I think there's some merit to that. I think that Lincoln himself, being born in an age of white supremacy, probably had some racist viewpoints. But you do see through policies, you do see through his speeches, you know, I don't want to say an evolution of position. I think he was always against slavery.
It was his comfort expressing that, yeah.
Right, right. But another thing to remember, too, is that Lincoln, just like any other political figure in that age, was a politician. So you're absolutely right that, you know, one of the things he's widely criticized for is the Lincoln-Douglas debates, where he expressly says that he wants the white person to have the superior position, or I'm paraphrasing, but it was something along those lines. And that's just in the years prior to what became the Civil War. So that is absolutely worthy of criticism. And I think it speaks to Lincoln, you know, trying to use, you know, any which statement to appeal to what was his voting base, or what was not his voting base, but the voting base, even
pretty much North. Because like there's a statement like probably prior to the Lincoln-Douglas debates where I think he was probably lower ranked. I don't think he was a senator at this point, but it was concerning, you know, whether they should authorize the Mexican-American War. And he had written, I don't know if he'd written a statement or if this is something he said aloud on the floor, but it was something to the effect of like, clearly they're doing this to annex more slave territory, and this is going to be a monstrous waste of blood. What are you guys talking about?
Mm-hmm.
Heavily paraphrasing what he said there. But like, it's, you know, the anti-slavery position has kind of existed, you know, in that historical space for a while, and how it kept getting brought up, you know, varied. And I kind of wonder what you make of this idea of like the inevitability of the Civil War. You know what I mean? Where it was something that was intentionally ignored or kind of pushed to the side or pushed under the rug by the founders. And it would just keep coming up in these kind of like, and not even just in the antebellum period, but even like through Jackson and whatnot. It was just this thing that how do we continue to push this to the side? And westward expansion may have, you know, been a release valve. Mm-hmm. But once we hit the end of the continent, this kind of struggle was going to be inevitable.
Yeah. Well, my thoughts on that are like, well, one, I think with the benefit of hindsight, we can always look back and say that, well, this was bound to happen. I think it was substantially likely to happen. I don't think a civil war was certain, all, you know, all but certain at that time, but it definitely happened. And you did have a powder keg with the kind of North versus South, free states versus slave states. And, you know, throughout the 1800s, essentially kicking the can down the road, or whatever the expression is, you know, with this Western expansion being a release valve, sure, but also a catalyst for more political conflict that was resolved several times. And I'm thinking, you know, Compromise 1820, Compromise of 1850, and it only succeeded in pushing secession down the line. I mean, I do think there's a possible world out there where, you know, one side acquiesced to the other. And I mean, thankfully, I mean, not that bloodshed is a good thing, but thankfully, I don't think the North was willing to allow that to happen. And as a result, yes, a lot of people died, but a lot of people are free now. You know, that's the big thing. I do think it's possible that if the North didn't have the positions that it took and didn't, you know, try to enforce its territorial claim, the Union's territorial claim, that history could have played out a lot differently. And yeah, so
I guess, you know, trying to juggle multiple balls here. I think, you know, in terms of favorite Civil War moments, if you've heard about Robert Smalls, who was like he escaped slavery, and then during the Civil War, he like took command of like a Confederate ship.
Stole
it from the Confederate Navy pretty much and brought it back to the Union. And then later, I think became a U.S. representative from Mississippi after the war.
No, that's the excuse me. That's the energy we like to see. That's awesome.
We love to see it, folks. We love to see it. I think
that's your favorite moment.
That's one of many. I think there's another one. I recall hearing. I forget who and all was involved, but I think there was like a Confederate general who like got apprehended by a private, I think, behind enemy lines. Okay. And because, like, you know, how much of these like Confederate guys were fancy lads, he was like, "You can't arrest me. Get yourself a major or something. Get a captain here." And they basically, like, he was the equivalent of calling the manager. And like they called a major or something to like arrest this Confederate general. But that was like a hilarious moment of like, you're a general and you got caught by a private. That's funny.
Yeah, it's like they want. I remember. I can't remember the names of the general, but I do remember that concept or moment.
The anecdote, for sure.
For sure. Yeah. The whole like, oh well, no, come on, can't you have a general arrest me? Don't be chivalrous, guys. Come on.
That kind of fancy lad culture of the South.
What's it called? Even at the end of the Civil War, at the courthouse when Grant's meeting with Lee, you have, you know, Lee, this Southern aristocrat, coming in his full dress uniform. Grant shows up in his like normal garb. It's just insult to injury at that point. We love to see it.
It kind of goes to show, like, we didn't kind of get at this earlier, but something that's funny about when we think about the Confederacy and like who their command was and even some of the rank and file, I mean, these were aristocrats at the end of the day. These were fancy lads trying to defend the system of making profit at the end of the day.
At the end of the day, that's exactly right. I you know, it's not all, but definitely most of the Confederate generals were of the aristocratic class. I mean, you had
One guy, States Rights Gibbs. There was a general named States Rights Gibbs, I think.
States Rights Gibbs, that's a lame name. I don't know about that guy. But the probably the one exception that, you know, people who subscribe to the Lost Cause myth really love to talk about and highlight is Stonewall Jackson. That's Thomas Jackson in general.
Fuck that guy.
Yeah, he's a bit of a weirdo. You know, he wasn't. I think he's the one of the few exceptions of the aristocratic class. At least he didn't grow up that way, if I remember correctly. But became one of the Confederate generals and rose to fame that way. Very, very eccentric guy, kind of a, what's it called? Kind of an outlier. Mm-hmm. And the people who are pro-Confederacy even to this day tend to really like him. But I believe he owned slaves and he's obviously fighting for the wrong side.
There's also the bad something side. Something to be said too, like because of the aristocratic nature of the South. Military service was valued as something to put on your resume, and a lot of these guys, you know, even if they didn't come from these planter backgrounds, were still guys who, like, you know, cut their teeth at West Point, and that's often been cited as a reason why some of the early Union generals like weren't enthusiastic about the fight or didn't seem to take the conflict seriously. Mm-hmm. Is because they were like, come on guys, do we really have to do this?
Yeah, yeah. No, you had a lot of both Union and Confederate generals coming from West Point. And to your point, I think it was the first Bull Run or the Battle of First Manassas, where I don't think anyone was taking it seriously at first. The only guy, not the only guy taking it seriously, that was a big battle for Stonewall Jackson, coming in and ensuring a Confederate victory at the last moment. But there were people just getting together and with picnic, like a picnic basket, and watching the battle.
Just watching.
Like, oh, this is going to be a decent show and chivalry, and then it just ended up being completely bloody, and people had to leave.
Civil war was not an adjective. Civil was not the adjective.
No, the operative word is war there. Okay. So that ended up happening, to your point.
Also, I looked up the guy, states' rights Gist. Can you, the listener can't see this, but, you know, imagine. Whoa,
what's going on his ear there? What's on his ear?
Dude, this is your lieutenant corporal. You're about to die, this dysentery, man. Come on.
Oh, no.
I'm trying to think. Another cool figure that, like, doesn't get discussed enough, and maybe we can segue this into, like, our alternative history discussion, I guess, is
sure.
Benjamin Butler. So he was a former, like, Northern Democrat who sticks with the Union. I forget what his exact reasons were, but decides, like, you know, to send out, like, a force of Democrats who are loyal to the Union. And I think at some point is the military governor of New Orleans when he captures it.
Okay.
And there's just, like, stories of, like, people trying to deface the Union flag, and he had them hanged, stuff like that. Or, like,
oh, wow.
Women would throw, like, chamber pots at him. So he would put up, like, an ordinance of, like, any woman caught after 7 p.m. is going to be in trouble type stuff.
But I just looked up this guy, and
he's ugly.
I was like, his picture, he's got more of a receding hairline than I do, like, three times over. And that's saying something.
Man, it was the dysentery back then. At least
got it. Yeah, the dysentery really got him.
But actually, no, like, another cool thing he did is, like, he was responsible for sanitizing a lot of the water during the Southern campaign, because, like, yellow fever would, like, propagate in the swamps especially. And he had, like, a plan to keep the soldiers safe by, like, doing stuff like that. There was also a lot of that, like, corruption of the era type stuff where, like, in addition to serving in the Union Army, his company also profited off of selling uniforms or something like that. You could never get away with that stuff today, but, like...
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it looks like there's a lot going on with this guy.
There's a lot. He's a very fascinating figure to read about.
He didn't look better when he was... earlier on. There's another picture of him in the 1860s.
He did not look
the exact same,
but
his hair is longer in the back.
Oh yeah This is when, like, you know, you could only grow a mullet. That was the only hairstyle. But yeah, he was very committed to, like, the radical Republican cause towards, like, at least I think after the Civil War, and, you know, was very much like an earlier advocate of equality between races. And he has, like, a very touching, like, thing he wrote about black soldiers who died under his command. That's, like, you know, very unique for the time, that I think is worth reading if people want to look it up. Yeah. But he had a shot at being Lincoln's VP at some point. And I almost, like, you know, want to imagine, like, Matt Crispin is the original guy who brought this up. And I heard this on, I forgot, on his vlog or on his podcast. I forgot, whatever. But there's, you know, if you get a guy like Butler to be Lincoln's VP and Lincoln does get shot, does having a radical Republican VP becoming president, you know, create a reconstruction effort that does more for people?
I think so. I mean, I think Andrew Johnson is widely regarded as one of the most, or one of the least favored among historians, presidents. And then just the bungling of Reconstruction, what could have been, you know, I think if you have somebody who's more focused on that effort, especially if it's Benjamin Butler, or think of it, it's Thaddeus Stevens or something, you know, you're going to have a more successful, depending on how you define successful, Reconstruction.
Or at least with more teeth.
With more teeth, yeah. And maybe you could have avoided some of the, you know, Jim Crow that inevitably came out of the South. Yeah. Well, another guy though, and not to completely detract it, that I mentioned is Thaddeus Stevens. You talk about this, you know, considered radical for the time, you know, he wanted equality. Ooh, radical.
No, Thaddeus Stevens.
But he's one of the people. I mean, he's, you know, more anti-slavery and more equality than Abraham Lincoln was at the time and after. And I mean, people don't really talk about Thaddeus Stevens, member of the House of Representatives, but as a quote unquote radical Republican, really pushing for equality. I mean, that kind of makes him a hero, especially given the time, at the time being white supremacy. Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, just another based figure.
Based also, and red also, pilled.
He looks a little bit better than Benjamin Butler, but
I'm trying to think the only good looking figure to come out of this entire like scrum, I think is Grant.
Oh, yeah,
and he's not Grant, even that he looks good. He's just styling. Looks decent.
Yeah, he looks pretty decent.
Sherman, on the other hand, oh my gosh, Sherman looks rough as hell.
He looks pretty rough. Yeah, he looks pretty rough, but he's one of those guys too. Sherman being a very controversial figure, especially among people who subscribe to the Lost Cause myth, they think he's like a war criminal.
Exactly.
But really helped along with Grant and some of the other Union generals towards the end secure the victory for the Union. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Sherman at the end of the day, like, coming from, like, you know, some of those military victories, whether it's the burning of Atlanta is one thing. But I think one of the most unique things about Sherman's career, and this was something that happened as a wartime exigency that I think, you know, could have been beneficial, mm-hmm. was, you know, as they were, like, kind of expropriating the land from Southern slaveholders, he basically tried to come up with the idea of it's easier for us to, instead of transporting free slaves and trying to hold the land, if we give people 40 acres and a mule, which that's the origin of the expression, I believe.
Oh, really?
To hold the land and maintain it for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you do like the second job of like not only freeing people, now you provide them with, you know, the means to take care of themselves. But now the land is occupied. You know what I mean? You don't have to put Union soldiers on it to guard it. And right. I know, you know, that gets tumultuous with eminent domain and whatnot, but that's one of those wartime exigencies that could have, you know, done things.
Yeah. Well, you know, Sherman subscribed to innovation when it came to war. And I mean, that's present in, did you say that was something that could have happened or did happen? I'm actually not.
That's something that did happen. And then I think at the end of the war, they were like, okay, no, they can't occupy that land.
Oh, okay. Well, he at least in regard to fighting the war and in terms of how he helped benefit the Union, which ultimately was on the right side there, fought kind of a total war strategy. And this is what is regarded as controversial. It's probably not as controversial today, but instead of defending dots of land, like a lot of the Confederate generals who are, you know, again, widely regarded, oh, they're military geniuses, that, well, they had less resources and they tried to defend plots of land. And I think that ultimately did them in. Sherman, on the other hand, just cutting himself off from his supply line and marching down through the South and, you know, destroying factories and other wartime suppliers, really, in addition to, you know, Grant's campaign and some of the latest victories in the Union at the time, helped secure the victory for the Union. Mm-hmm. You know, there's some bad stuff that happened, you know, Union soldiers committing crimes and you know, burning of civilian houses, and there's you know, abuses of southern civilians and everything, and that's and of course you can all say that that's imputed knowledge or imputed blame towards Sherman. You know, he should know what's going on in his army and figure it out, but he's criticized for that. You can subscribe to a the buck stops here mentality. I think that's valid, but overall, I mean, Sherman marching down was a and making Georgia howl, or so to speak, was a probably a big victory for the Union. And some of those criticisms being valid, I mean, that doesn't take away from the fact that was probably the right way to fight the war. Not the abuses on the citizenry, but the you know, burning of factories and
the path to win.
For the path to win, right? And total war nowadays is not probably as controversial as it was back in the day. But
well, I mean, especially like something I find funny is, you know, the people who complain about the Union Army's, you know, wartime abuses don't really seem bothered by any other wartime abuses in the modern day. So yeah, that's kind of like, you know, a fallacy I kind of dismiss out there and out hand.
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was going to say, yeah, nowadays and back in the day, I mean, you can't, I don't mean to be like, oh, but what about this? What about ism? But I mean, you can criticize the Union Army for, and rightly do so, for some of the abuses that happened perpetrated by the soldiers, you know, especially during Sherman's march. You can rightly criticize that while acknowledging the merit of that whole effort. But to do that, you know, you often see that, you know, Sherman's a war criminal from people who subscribe to the lost cause myth, but then you don't talk about Confederate generals, you know, and,
owning people.
Yeah. I mean, you don't talk about them, and you don't talk about their like summarily executing black Union soldiers without taking prisoners. I mean, I definitely wasn't every Confederate general, but it was some. And I mean, to not acknowledge that and to cast the Union as the bad guy, given everything we know about the Confederacy and what they were doing to black Union soldiers and you know, various other abuses, that's just, yeah, inconsistent.
That, and it wasn't even universally supported. You know what I mean? It was, I think I really do agree with that assessment of the Civil War as kind of a aristocrat's conflict that was imposed on the South.
I think so, but I mean, and I think that that's a valid take, especially given a lot of the generals who were from the aristocratic class. But you have to understand too, I mean, there was in some of the journals of the Confederate soldiers, you know, not all. I mean, soldiers went to fight for various reasons.
Yeah,
some,
yeah.
Just to give credit to some Confederate soldiers, they were fighting to, you know, quote unquote, protect their homes, or they were fighting because of fear of servile insurrection, which I defined earlier, which again, ironically, never ended up happening. Or they were fighting to preserve slavery. I mean, I think the statistic is 30% of the soldiers fighting in the Confederacy were slave owners themselves. So, I mean, at a certain point, yeah, I mean, the aristocrats were the generals. It was a political conflict, but I think that there was large support among the common soldiery to fight the war.
That's true.
Mm.
And I think, you know, you can direct that with propaganda and with, you know, that kind of popular messaging. So I think that's, you know, that's very fair.
Oh, yeah.
Especially considering the economics of the South and how that is how wealth was created in the South, through plantations, not, you know,
small. Yeah, not through industry. Right.
Exactly. Side question, would you do a Civil War reenactment?
Oh, I totally would.
You would?
But I gotta be on the Union.
Of course. That goes without question.
Definitely. Oh, a Civil War reenactment of like Gettysburg or something would be, that would just, I would be nerding out so much. Oh my god. Yeah. What about you?
No, I would. I would look out of place, but I mean, I would do it. Put me in the cavalry. I'm fucking in.
Yeah. I just hope we both end up doing a Civil War reenactment. Like, it'd be like, wait, is that Adi Tewari? Wait, why are you in the Confederacy, Adi? No.
Let's do a colorblind casting. I'm fucking U.S. Grant. Let's do it. Let's do
U.S. Grant. All right.
Yeah.
So yeah,
there's a lot to talk about with the Civil War.
There is. Again, I mean, if you don't mind me pivoting the conversation a little bit, I think that really, what's it called? We talked about the zigzag line that, you can draw from Civil War history to the, some of the struggles of today.
Right.
And, I think one of the things, and just to underscore this, I'm not sure if I said this earlier, but the Lost Cause myth is this rebranding kind of perversion of what the Civil War was all about. And I think there's a miss. We talked about how it's represented in education, the American Civil War, and kind of the summary that happens that maybe misses some of the inferences or expounding that should happen. Where was I going with that? But basically, I think people who subscribe to the Lost Cause myth, and I think people who don't subscribe to the Lost Cause myth really misunderstand certain aspects of Civil War history. Exactly. And I think when you talk about the Confederate statues being one example, or people, go to any Civil War videos, YouTube comments, you'll find at least one Confederate sympathizer who's like, oh, well, it wasn't about slavery. It was about tariffs, or it was about Northern aggression, states' rights. And yeah, it's a what states' rights to do what, look at the Confederate leaders and the ordinances of secession, and you'll see what it was all about: slavery. In the institution of slavery, preserving and expanding it. And that's misunderstood. But people also seem to think of the North as the de facto good guys. And I mean, given what the Confederacy was about, yeah, it was about that. But at first, Abraham Lincoln and the North, the Union, didn't join the Civil War to end slavery. They joined it to preserve, or they fought it to preserve the Union. That it eventually evolved and to save the Union, to preserve the Union, and to get their territory back and stuff. But it evolved eventually into the Emancipation Proclamation, the end of slavery, and Abraham Lincoln and other political figures championing that. So I think there's misunderstanding on many sides of the Civil War about what the Civil War was about, what the political climate was at the time, sanctifying the North or wrongfully demonizing the North, and definitely wrongfully sanctifying the South. So I feel like people would benefit from our earlier point from this, just learn the historical facts. And you get a better picture about what this was all about.
Yeah. And I think, in addition to learning the historical facts, I'm not even saying dryly read a book, but I think something that gets missed out because education sucks, school sucks, and I get why people tune out. But I think something that I wish more teachers, expounded on, or maybe what society expounded on, is history is a moving process. It's not exactly discrete events, people, and things.
Right.
It's a moving process, and there's events that happen that are dynamic, and there's no clear, except for maybe every now and then there's a person you could say is a heroic figure. Mm-hmm. Very rarely, are people explicitly good and bad. But there are conflicts and contradictions that are based in, discussions of justice, in discussions of doing the right thing, of making society, you know, better. And it's through that process-oriented understanding of history that these discussions make sense.
Yeah. You're basically saying, and I wholeheartedly agree, that historic events don't happen in a vacuum. They happen as a result of all of the variables, culture, political happenings 5-10 years ago and beyond, as a result of all that coming together into, usually there's a catalyst for a big event like the Civil War, but it doesn't just happen in the vacuum. And we can look at some of the things of today, some of the events and controversies of today, whether it be you know, racial justice, whether it be, you know, issues about what is history and what is sanctifying a terrible cause. It really, I mean, you know, sometimes you can't draw a clean line, but you can draw a line from some of these events that happen, you know, Civil War into failed Reconstruction, into progressive politics, into blatant racism and white supremacy mobs, and redlining and unequal treatment and Jim Crow and all that.
You name it. Yeah.
You name it. And, you know, I think an understanding of history starting at the Civil War, maybe earlier, really helps us put into context what some of the struggles of yesterday and what some of the struggles of today are. And I think everybody would benefit from that.
Exactly. Well, history aside, I know you play, what's that game?
Ultimate General Civil War. That's Civil War game.
Oh my God. I think I had started playing Civ with y'all, like I think at the start of the pandemic, and that was my first introduction to like that kind of God view. What is it called? Strategy? Real-time strategy games?
Real-time strategy. Yeah. I mean, Civilization, 5 that you're playing with us, that was, yeah, it's kind of like quasi real-time strategy. The Ultimate General Civil War game is definitely real-time strategy. Where you're playing, you know, you can speed up and slow down and pause the speed of the battles and everything. But
how quick do they usually go?
Oh, I mean, you could play some of those. It depends on how, I think it depends on the battle and everything. There are some smaller battles that can take somewhere between 15 minutes, half hour, maybe gotcha. Less. But the big battles, the multiple day events in that game, it's a single player game where you're taking control of the Union Army, or if you're a scrub, the Confederate Army, and basically you're moving the what are they called, you know, divisions and battalions of troops into favorable positions and winning the battles. And you know, I'm a big believer that art inspires, you know, what would be the word, art inspires substance or science or history. So you play some of these games and you develop a real interest if you didn't have it before and what actually happened on those days. So, I mean, I would play some of those battles in Ultimate General Civil War. And then, you know, I'd be like, well, what actually happened during that battle? You know,
right.
And I'd look it up, and now as a result, I know a lot more about the military strategy that went on.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so it's cool.
Yeah, the only exposure I've had is the Civ 5 simulations. And they have two, which again, like, if you're a scrub, you can play as the Confederates. I'm going to be honest. I don't care if this impinges on any fucking First Amendment rights. It should be banned. Playing as the Confederacy should be banned.
Playing as the Confederacy?
Yeah, it should be banned.
In video games?
In video games should be banned. I think we can all agree on that. But I tried playing the scenario where you're playing Lincoln trying to win in the last 100 days of the Civil War, I think, or you were trying to, it's a simulation where you try
to
win.
Scenario. Yeah.
And I just like, I fucked up on the first turn and I like quit the game. I'm like, I can't risk this. I can't risk the Union collapsing.
Yeah. That's a lot of pressure for one person. So you appreciate what Grant and everything had to go through. Grant, General, U.S. Grant sitting there playing Civ 5 is exactly how that happened.
Resurrect Except Grant and let him play Civ 5.
What the fuck's going on? what's it called? I actually have a very similar experience with the Civ 5 scenario. I think I played a couple of turns. And I was like, what the hell is this? I don't want to play this. So I turned that off, loaded up Ultimate General Civil War. And I played that for like a year straight through the pandemic, like multiple campaigns of the Union. You just get better every time. I eventually, even though I know you want to ban them, I did, for the sake of completing the game, it took me about a year and a half, but then I eventually played the.
Oh, so you have to play the Confederacy to play the game. God damn it.
You don't have to, but it's
but if
like
you want that 100%
whole other half of the game. Yeah. Gotcha. So I did. It took me like a year and a half of just playing the Union to eventually get around to it. What's it called? So now I eventually did there. So I'm a bit of a scrub, but at least I held out for a year and a half. Yeah. Cool stuff. The worst Civil War game that you should never buy is a game sponsored by the History Channel called Civil War, original. It's like the PlayStation 3 and probably other consoles. It's just like the worst game I've ever played. Not even the Civil War. Just
the worst game. Was the setup? Was it like a
real-time strategy? It's not real-time strategy. It's like first-person shooter, but like
shit.
Yeah, but it's like bad. It's like bad.
Because like rifles and shit, right? Like they weren't.
There's a disproportionate amount of repeating rifles in that game to make up for the slow reload speeds of real life. So like they kind of stretch history a little bit. That's not like the worst part of the game, but there's some bug where if you aim down the sights, like your rifle like misses every so. And maybe that's realistic, but that's kind of like it takes you a minute to kill a guy, and then they just don't have any real story behind it. You just basically, they throw you into five different Confederate battles as a one soldier and five different Union battles. And the gameplay is just not very enthralling.
Gotcha. There could be a way to make a game where it's like you're stuck on that line as a Union troop or whatever, and you just have a rifle and it's still like an FPS setup, but the anxiety factor could be so high.
Yeah.
And you could be penalized for the reload if you missed, that you could probably make a good FPS in the Civil War era. You probably could, but it would have to be so anxiety inducing.
Yeah. A better way to induce that anxiety too could be like virtual reality component too.
With you. Oh, fuck me.
Yeah. That'd be crazy. But there are games, I think, where there's third person shooters. I can't remember. They're like the games online. I can't remember what they're called. It was like Total War or something, or is it something like that, where War of Rights? I can't remember what it's called. But there is some game you could probably find on YouTube, like Civil War Simulation not Battle Royale, but Civil War Simulation something. And there's like these 50v50 battles or something like that, which basically you are fighting in a line. It's pretty cool to watch.
Yeah, I'm trying to think, like, maybe a Civil War trading card game. That's probably the next way you could monetize this. Otherwise, like, I think, yeah, RTS is only the only realistic genre you can probably portray a game and still have it be fun.
100 point value card. States right blit.
States right Gibbs.
Gibbs, yeah. The gold tier card.
God damn it.
He's like Exodia.
This is my flaming Sherman card.
Yeah, the flaming Sherman card. Blue eyes, Sherman.
Oh god. Yu-Gi-Oh, but for fucking Civil War.
Yu-Gi-Oh. We got a battle, Stonewall Boy. Yeah.
God damn it. Yeah, this was a pretty ambitious topic for us to cover. Like, I feel like we made good ground despite
knowing nothing. That was
despite knowing nothing.
We have no knowledge on this topic, and yet we discussed it for over an hour. I think that's great.
That's podcasting. And I mean, if anyone complains, hey, it's a free show.
It's a free show.
You chose to watch this. Come on, guys.
Yeah. Well, it was really good. It was really good talking to you about Civil War. Happy to nerd out about Civil War at any time.
This was a fun one. I think, you know, maybe I want to do some more research next time we do like a historical discussion.
Sure.
But yeah, no, I think this was solid.
Solid.
Thanks again for coming on, Zach. Is there anything you want to plug or anything you want the listeners to know?
No. Actually, while we're talking about the American Civil War, there is a YouTuber who presents on the American Civil War and has really good, interesting discussion. There's also the video series called Checkmate Lincolnites, which is very funny and entertaining and educational. It's from a guy called Atun Shea. And I can't remember the exact spelling of the name. I remember the first four letters are A-T-U-N. You could probably find that if you search A-T-U-N and then Checkmate Lincolnites. You'll find him. That's the YouTube channel I'd like to plug. And I think it's educational, helpful, very entertaining.
Yeah, I found the guy's YouTube channel, so I can definitely plug that in the description and stuff.
Perfect.
Well, thanks for tuning in, dear listener. This has been Greenhouse Gaslighting. I'm your host, Adi. You can follow us on Twitter at @PodGreenhouse. And I'll plug all our social media links and stuff below. You know where to find it. Until next time, see you all in the greenhouse. Take care. Union boys will win the battles right away. Come away, right away. We'll all go down to Dixie away.